It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. The U.S. Secretary of State speaks with the President of Russia. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he had frank talks about Ukraine, Syria, and Iran with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. Speaking at a news conference in Sochi with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov, the top U.S. diplomat said the talks come in the midst of a challenging time. Before sitting down with Mr. Putin, Secretary Kerry met with Mr. Lavrov for more than 4 hours. Mr. Kerry's trip comes at a time when relations between the U.S. and Russia have plummeted amid the disagreements over Ukraine and Syria. The trip appeared designed to maintain contact. A strong earthquake struck Nepal on Tuesday, Anjana Pasricha reports.
As the ground shook once again, people fled their homes into the streets. Shops that had reopened just days ago hastily closed. The quake struck shortly after noon local time and was followed by powerful shocks. The streets remained packed for hours as people wondered what lay in store for them next. Television footage showed Nepal's parliament shake as the quake struck. The airport was shut down temporarily. Power went off in the capital, Kathmandu. The epicenter of the latest earthquake lay in an isolated area close to Mount Everest and Nepal's border with Tibet. Anjana Pasricha of New Delhi.
Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports magnitude 6.8 earthquake struck Japan today off the coast of Miyagi Prefecture. The quake struck the same region devastated by a major quake and a tsunami in 2011. U.S. officials say a U.S. Marine Corps helicopter disappeared in Nepal during relief efforts following the quake. A military spokesman says the craft went missing around 10 p.m. local time Tuesday while conducting relief operations. This is VOA News. South Korean intelligence is reporting that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had his defense minister executed for apparently falling asleep at a military event. Seoul's Yonhap news agency quotes an intelligence official as saying Hyun Yong-chol, whose former title was Minister of the People's Armed Forces, was shot to death by an anti-aircraft gun. Hundreds of officials watched Hyun's execution on April 30th. Han Ki-byeon, the deputy director of South Korea's National Intelligence Agency, told a paramilitary committee in Seoul on Wednesday. Yonhap says Mr. Kim believed Hyun, who was appointed to his post less than a year ago, showed disloyalty and disrespect by dozing off. He also was reported to have challenged Mr. Kim on previous occasions. A demonstrator was killed Tuesday when Burundi police opened fire on protesters in Bujumbura. More than a dozen people have been killed in the often violent protests over President Pierre Nkurunziza's plans to run for a third term in office. This latest death comes on the eve of an East African Community Summit in Tanzania called to discuss Burundi's ongoing unrest. A five-day humanitarian ceasefire is underway in Yemen. It was called to give the United Nations a chance to bring food and supplies to civilians caught in the middle of the conflict. Shiite Houthi rebels and the Saudi-led coalition fought nearly up to the last minute. A U.S. defense official is urging an Iranian ship purportedly carrying aid to Yemen to change its course and head to Djibouti, where the United Nations is overseeing humanitarian deliveries. Carla Babb reports for VOA.
Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the U.S. is tracking the Iran Shahid vessel after Tehran said it would send warships to escort it to Yemen, where Tehran-backed Houthi rebels are fighting pro-government forces supported by Saudi Arabia.
If the Iranians are planning some sort of stunt in the region, they know as well as we do that it would be unhelpful. And it, in fact, could potentially threaten the ceasefire that's been so painstakingly brought about.
Warren would not comment on what the U.S. would do should the ship try to dock at Yemen. Carla Babb, The Pentagon.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Three Somali men pleaded guilty in a New York courtroom Tuesday to conspiring to help the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. By pleading guilty, the three avoid possible lifetime prison terms and will now serve up to 15 years behind bars. Two of the suspects, Ali Yasin Ahmed and Mohammed Yusuf, are Swedish citizens. The third, Mati Hashi, lived in Britain before his British citizenship was revoked. And President Obama challenged Americans Tuesday to do more to alleviate poverty in the U.S. and close the widening income equality gap between the country's wealthy and its middle class. Joe Palca from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A peacemaking forum has ended in the Central African Republic with an agreement.
So far, 9 armed groups in the Central African Republic have signed the agreement on disarming, demobilizing, and reintegrating or repatriating their fighters. Organizers are still waiting for a smaller group led by the veteran rebel Abdoulaye Miskine to sign.
That's correspondent Nick Long in Goma and the DRC. The United Nations says thousands are fleeing fighting in South Sudan's Unity State. A missing activist is likely to dominate the visit to Zimbabwe this week of 2 U.S. envoys. And East African leaders meet today on the crisis in Burundi as the Catholic Church issues an ultimatum.
A few minutes ago now, the Catholic Church, they just said that it's impossible to continue the electoral process without letting the media do their work. The president must free the radios, let them be on air again in the countryside.
Innocent Muhuzi is general manager of the Renaissance Radio and Television Network in Burundi. We have reaction to a European Union proposal on immigrants question, and Boko Haram captives describe how the militants are obsessed with marriage. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A peacemaking forum in the Central African Republic has ended with a Republican pact, an agreement on disarming and demobilizing armed groups. Nick Long reports for VOA from Goma, Eastern Congo.
So far, 9 armed groups in the Central African Republic have signed the agreement on disarming, demobilizing and reintegrating or repatriating their fighters. Organizers are still waiting for a smaller group led by the veteran rebel Abdoulaye Miskine to sign. A diplomatic source told VOA the 9 groups include nearly all the significant rebel movements in the country. But in most cases, it wasn't the military commanders of those groups who signed the document on Monday. It was the leaders of their political wings. One armed group commander, the self-styled General Joseph Sundeko of the RPRC, was reported as saying after the signing ceremony, "It's good that the politicians have agreed to sign, but the realities on the ground are another thing." Sundeko told reporters he had several reservations about the agreement. "There are some things in the agreement we don't like," he says. "We're supposed to assemble our men at certain sites, but if we assemble them, how will they eat and how will they go and earn money? The agreement says recruitment to the army will be individual and progressive, but soldiers' work is collective," he adds. However, the RPRC's political leader, Herbert Jean-Tron Jono Ahaba, nephew of the CAR's former president Michel Djotodia, downplayed these critical comments. He said, "As for the attitude of certain officers, that's a problem the group will solve so that it stays firmly within the peace process." CAR has had peacemaking forums before in 2003 and 2008. Some regional analysts suggest this one seems less likely to lead to a power-sharing deal between armed group leaders in advance of elections, as happened after the previous 2 dialogues. The biggest armed group, the Anti-Balaka, called at the forum for a government reshuffle, but most of the participants, who came from political parties and civil society, rejected that proposal. The Republican Pact agreed at the forum calls for a new constitution and for the establishment of a court to try war crimes. The pact does not seem to offer major concessions to the armed group leaders' ambitions. The agreement commits the government and international partners to feed and look after the demobilized combatants until they are either recruited by the army or helped to rejoin civilian life. A diplomat told VOA that money still needs to be raised for much of this process. CAR descended into violence in 2013 after mostly Muslim rebels ousted the president, followed by revenge attacks by Christians on Muslims. An international peacekeeping force has restored a tenuous calm. Nick Long for VOA News.
In Burundi, the powerful Catholic Church has given President Pierre Nkurunziza until Sunday, May 17th, to allow independent radio and television stations to resume broadcasting, or it will ask church members on the Electoral Commission to leave. Burundi's independent media has been severely affected by the ongoing political unrest in the country, sparked by President Nkurunziza's decision to run for a 3rd term. This comes as leaders of the 5-nation East African community are meeting today, Wednesday, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Innocent Muhuzi is general manager of the Renaissance Radio and Television Network in Burundi. He said the protesters want the East African leaders to tell President Nkurunziza to abandon his 3rd-term bid because he is prohibited by the Arusha Accord.
Our constitution is from the Arusha Peace Agreement. And this Arusha Peace Agreement is saying that no one will be able to rule this country more than 10 years. If a president has a first mandate of 5 years, he just can run for a second term only one time. That means that no one can do more than 10 years ruling this country. And our constitution is saying that for the first mandate in 2005, exceptionally that the president will not be elected by the direct vote by the people, but have been elected by the Senate and the parliament together. So it's not about the way the president was elected. It's about the number of mandates that he could have at the head of the country. That's the whole problem.
There was a proposal by the European Union and the United States that perhaps the election should be delayed. What are the protesters saying? Do they support that?
For any person that has his head clear, it's obvious that the vote should be delayed, because today you can even not go in an office or in a store in Bujumbura. And the president yesterday began campaigning in the countryside while he knows that all the communes of Bujumbura are locked off by police and the army. And also radios are locked off from the countryside. Even a few minutes ago now, the Catholic Church, they just said that it's impossible to continue the electoral process without letting the media do their work. The president must free the radios, let them be on air again in the countryside, and postpone the elections. If not done like that, they say that the 70th of this month, the Catholic Church will ask his members who are in the Electoral Commission to get out of Independent Electoral Commission.
There were protests again on Tuesday. What happened?
Very, very big protest this Tuesday. And the new thing was that there were a lot of women and girls in this protest asking for the president to stop running for the third term.
How is the media covering this? Are you free to cover the protest and to broadcast?
We are free to cover, even if some people, those close to the ruling party, they are beating some of our crews. They are trying to take our equipment out of them. Today, 5 journalists escape being killed by the young people of the ruling party. They take the equipment out of them. They run after them. They throw stones on them. They really had to run very fast to escape from being killed. The other thing is that, as you may know, that all those independent media, those independent radio, they now cannot reach the countryside. They are just allowed to broadcast on the capital city only because their transmitters have been switched off by the government.
Innocent Muhozi is general manager of the Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The UN Human Rights Office says civilians are bearing the brunt of renewed fighting this month in South Sudan's oil-rich Unity State. The agency says thousands of people have been fleeing to escape attacks by government and opposition forces. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights says it is alarmed by escalating violence involving government and opposition forces in South Sudan's strategic oil-rich Unity State. Since fighting erupted at the end of April, the agency says about 2,200 civilians have sought refuge and protection at the UN mission in South Sudan in the state capital, Bantou. It says many others have fled into the bush near villages south of Nialdu, Koch, and Lir. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says about a quarter of the new arrivals are children under 5, and 2/3 of them are women and girls. He says there are alarming reports of attacks, abductions, and sexual violence by armed men around the UN site in Bantou.
At least 28 villages have been attacked and civilians killed and maimed. Others have been abducted, and there's also been conflict-related sexual violence and looting of property. All the villages attacked have been burned, and cattle and other properties have been looted.
Colville says people who fled the area told aid workers that those committing these atrocities are soldiers from the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, and armed youth.
Mobilized youths are reportedly wearing civilian clothes, but are armed with AK-47s, whereas the SPLA soldiers are armed with rocket-propelled grenades, tanks, and mounted pickups, in addition to other weapons.
Members of the SPLA, which is South Sudan's army, are fighting for both sides in the conflict. United Nations and other aid agencies pulled out of Northern Unity State over the weekend because of the fighting, leaving an estimated 300 civilians without essential aid. The 17-month-long war between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar has left the world's newest country in chaos, with more than 1 million people either displaced within South Sudan or as refugees in neighboring countries. The rainy season is not far off. UN agencies are urging the warring factions to stop or ease back on the fighting so people can plant their crops and avoid hunger later this year. In the meantime, the UN warns that attacks on civilians and infrastructure violate international humanitarian law and human rights laws. It says alleged crimes must be investigated. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, May 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Two U.S. diplomats are visiting Zimbabwe this week, a rare occurrence in recent years because of frosty U.S.-Zimbabwean relations. Sebastian Mofu looks at the purpose of their visit as Zimbabwe pushes for an end to travel and financial sanctions against its leaders.
A U.S. statement says Shannon Smith, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, and Stephen Feldstein, the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, will meet with government officials, business leaders, and civil society organizations during their four-day visit to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's Permanent Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Joey Bima, said Harare wants to re-engage with Washington. The U.S., along with many other Western countries, imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe's leadership in 2002 following reports of election rigging and human rights abuses. Independent analyst Pedzisai Ruhanya says the visitors will analyze Zimbabwe's political climate and the ruling ZANU-PF party.
To assess whether the environment, the political environment, is stable enough for the U.S. government to review its policies against Zimbabwe. You may remember that the European Union lifted the sanctions apart from those that relate to the First Lady and the President. And I think that they will be largely disappointed. Largely disappointed because of the missing of human rights activists like Itai Dzamara. So what ZANU-PF is doing will not advance its cause to do business with America.
Activist Itai Dzamara went missing on March 9. Zimbabwean police says Zamara's wife last saw her husband when five men forced him into a car before driving off. The opposition and civic organizations have accused President Robert Mugabe's government of being behind the abduction. Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa told Parliament that Harare had no issue with the missing activist and will arrest whoever kidnapped him.
We are a democratic society, and anybody in this country who commits crime must account for the crime they commit.
More than 2 months down the line, the activist has yet to be found. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Today, Wednesday, the European Union Commission is expected to propose that EU member countries accept a certain number of refugees under a quota program. The move is aimed to stem the current migration crisis that has seen more than 1,800 migrants died already while trying to cross from Africa to Europe by boat. Kathleen Newland, co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute, tells Reiki Shryak why the proposal could be controversial to some EU member states.
It's not going to address the causes of the crisis, but it is a way to address the short-term humanitarian considerations, which really have to be paramount, that is, saving lives in the Mediterranean and coming to a humane resolution for people who are picked up at sea. We still don't know many of the details of the plan, nor do we know how the negotiations will proceed after proposals are made by the Commission. the member states of the European Union are deeply divided about the proposal to have a, what they call a distribution key, that is a formula for distributing refugees and asylum seekers.
And do you know if this proposal, does it mean a certain amount of the migrants who are being found in these boats, or does it mean a certain amount of refugees in total?
This proposal is to deal with people arriving across the Mediterranean. Now, the formula for the distribution key may take in things like how many refugees or asylum seekers from other modes of entry a country is experiencing. That may be one of the things that's taken into account, along with the size of the country, the population, GDP, the level of unemployment. You know, there are a whole range of factors that could be included in any formula, and I'm sure that will be one of the points of negotiation among the EU member states.
Have there been discussions among the EU member states as well about the process of legally migrating to these countries?
It is very difficult. And the EU member states have, you know, a certain set of criteria that for immigration. And they are mainly, they mainly have to do with family unification and skills that are needed in the labor market.
What about outside of refugees, economic migrants?
The opportunities for job seekers, unless they are highly skilled, is very, very limited in Europe. Many of the European countries still have extremely high unemployment rates, especially youth unemployment, as a sort of hangover from the Great Recession. Now, this is despite the sort of long-term picture in which it's very clear aging population, European countries are going to need migrants, but they haven't yet really figured out how to fill those labor market needs in an orderly way.
Kathleen Newland is co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. As it took over huge parts of Nigeria's northeast last year, Boko Haram fighters were looking not just to indoctrinate female captors to their brand of radical Islam, but also to marry them. Chris Stein reports on how the group used marriage to subjugate its captives.
During the 5 months the Boko Haram extremist group held Kolo Telba captive, the militants took away one of her sons, never to be seen again, and let another one become so sick that he died shortly after the Nigerian military rescued Telba late last month. One thing the militants didn't do was try to marry her. In fact, when they found out she was expecting, Telba says they left her and a group of other pregnant women alone. Telba says the fighters would bring the women food periodically, but generally the group was left alone. In the past few weeks, Nigeria's military has rescued hundreds of abducted women, girls, and children as it advanced into the Sambisa Forest, one of the extremist group's last strongholds. VOA spoke with some of the women who are among a group of 275 former captives brought to the Malkohi Displaced Persons Camp outside the northeastern city of Yola. Many describe Boko Haram fighters as being as preoccupied with marriage as they are with their six-year campaign to impose strict Islamic law across Nigeria's northeast. When the militants raided the town of Maidegale last August, they murdered Hadiza Yusuf's husband and took her away to Sambisa Forest. There, the fighters gave her a choice: marry one of them or become a slave. Yusuf refused to submit, so the militants forced her and other women to cook and do chores in the camp while raining insults on them. If they refused to do chores, the fighters would beat them. She isn't quite sure why the fighters wanted to get married so badly. Perhaps evil spirits possessed them, Yusuf says. Most of the fighters have about 5, 4, or 3 women, and they're not even legally married to them. But Yusuf says they just want to have the women all to themselves. Hawal Umar found herself in Sambisa after she was taken from the town of Damboa last December. Faced with the choice of forced marriage or slavery, she says she faked a mental illness to avoid the fighters' advances. Umar says she put a lot of rags on her body and wore a worn-out cap and made herself look as rough as possible. She says the militants were scared of her and didn't want to come close to her, saying, "How can you get married to a mad woman?" They'd approach her and say, "This is a mad girl, stay away from her." And Yusuf says they'd run away. Not all of the women taken into Sambisa were able to resist the fighters. Authorities are still trying to figure out the exact number, but a spokesman for United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said last week that a large number of the women rescued from Sambisa were pregnant. Chris Stein for VOA News, Malkohi, Nigeria.
Minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. African football is in mourning following the death of Ghana's Cecil Jones Atakwifio, who lost his fight against throat cancer in Accra on Tuesday. As a player, the highlight of his 10 years as a Black Stars defender was their winning of the 1965 Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Tunisia. Atakwifio's high point as a coach was in 2000 as the recipient of the inaugural Confederation of African Football Coach of the Year Award for guiding Accra-based Hearts of Oak to win the Orange Africa Champions League and Africa Super Cup. He was on the technical bench when Ghana clinched bronze medals at the 1992 Barcelona Olympics and 1999 FIFA Under-17 World Cup. Atakwifio served as Ghana Football Association Vice President and Secretary General in the mid-1980s and mid-1990s, respectively. On a more cheerful note in athletics, Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion Wenda Nell of South Africa aims high at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China in August, following her triumph in 54.90 seconds at the recent South Africa Open Track and Field Championships. She is also excited having run a lifetime best of 52.09 seconds in 400 meters flat.
It was very nice. I was excited. I went out quite hard. The aim was to try and run a PB, if not maybe sub 52, but fortunately and unfortunately, I ran 52.09, which I'm still very happy about. We had a slight wind in the back straight, so with all the circumstances taken into account, I'm really, really happy for my time.
Yeah, it was a personal best. What was your previous best?
It was 52.43. Last year, I ran 52.53. Yeah, I ran the 0.43 earlier this season.
So going forward, what are your general projections this year?
I especially use this weekend in preparation for the World Championships. We also have heats and semifinals and finals, the different rounds, but not too much rest in between. And I think I've conquered what I wanted to. Two hard races within 2 days. I'm really, really happy. I ran season's best with my hurdles today, so very excited for the season ahead.
That was South Africa's Wenda Nell, the Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion, speaking in Clokwe, Northwest Province in South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Three Somali men pleaded guilty in a New York courtroom on Tuesday to conspiring to help the Al-Shabaab-linked terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Their pleas came as jury selection was about to get underway for their trial. By pleading guilty, the three avoid possible lifetime prison terms and will now serve up to 15 years behind bars. Two of the suspects were charged with traveling to Somalia to fight with Al-Shabaab and conspiring to provide support for the group. Authorities in Djibouti arrested the three in 2012 after they entered from Somalia on their way to Yemen. That is it for this Wednesday, May 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Button, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.